It's my great privilege to introduce our keynote speaker tonight, the Honorable Michael B. Mercasey. Judge Mercasey was born in the Bronx in 1941. His father immigrated from the country that we now know as Belarus, which we all know was part of the Soviet Union. What I did not know until very recently, prior to being part of the Soviet Union, it was part of the Russian Empire. I suspect the historians in here know that. If we look at current events, I kind of wonder whether it might be part of the Russian Empire again someday. Judge Mercasey and his wife Susan have two children. He graduated from Columbia in 1963 and from Yale Law School in 1967. He practiced law in the city of New York for a couple of decades, with many of those years spent as an assistant U.S. attorney alongside Rudy Giuliani. Ronald Reagan then appointed him to the federal bench, where he served for 18 years in the Southern District of New York, with six of those years as the chief judge. He handled a number of very important cases. You probably would have heard of the sentencing of Omar Rahman. You probably know of him as the blind sheik. He also handled the case of Padilla versus Rumsfeld, which dealt with the power of the president to treat you or me or anyone else in here as an enemy combatant. And then he dealt with another one that I find very interesting, the Silverstein insurance cases. As you recall, there were two planes that hit the World Trade Center. There was about $3.5 billion worth of insurance. If that's one event, then it's $3.5 billion of insurance. If it's two events, that's $7 billion. Apparently, there were nine insurance policies, and the decision was a bit mixed, depending on which one you read. So I'll leave that one at that. Following the bench, he served as the 81st Attorney General under President Bush and currently is a partner at Debevoise and Plimpton. He's a frequent op-ed writer for the Wall Street Journal with numerous articles recently on felons' rights, as well as on, pertinent to our conference here, national security, the rights, the responsibilities of the government in collecting data and in holding that data. There are two quotations from Judge Mercasey that I would like to give to you. I found them both quite interesting. One of them occurred when a reporter from the New York Daily News asked him, he had just retired from the federal bench, and said, "Judge, you've handled all these important cases. Which one would you like to be remembered by?" And he cocked his head some and thought. He said, "You know, I don't think I'm quite ready to be remembered just yet." And the other one, this one I need to read to you, because this one is quite significant. And this comes from a Wall Street Journal article that the judge wrote last summer. And he said, "The Constitution and the United States laws are not a treaty with the universe. They protect United States citizens. Foreign governments spy on us, and they spy on our citizens. But guess what? We spy on them and their citizens. Welcome to the world." Judge Mercasey, welcome to the 33rd annual National Federalist Student Symposium. Welcome to the state of Florida and the Gator Nation. And my fellow Federalists, join me in welcoming the Honorable, the esteemed Michael B. Mercasey.
I want to thank Professor Willis for that kind introduction and the organizers of this symposium for giving me the honor of this podium. For those of you who are attending, because of your focus and your interest in issues that affect our security and our way of life, I want to thank him particularly for mentioning Belarus, because of course that illustrates a nice principle of physics that physicists discovered a long time ago, but that apparently politicians haven't discovered until very recently, which is that nature abhors a vacuum. And particularly in the world, nature abhors a vacuum of U.S. leadership, as we're finding out. And vacuums tend to get filled. And consider the way they're being filled in Syria, in Iran, in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Ukraine. We have, I think, a great deal to be concerned about. I think those developments are made significantly worse by what I want to talk to you principally about, which is what I believe is a crisis in U.S. intelligence gathering that's unmatched by anything I've seen or heard about in my lifetime. My lifetime has gone on for a whole lot longer than the lifetimes of most of the folks in this room. It's a multifaceted crisis in which information about our electronic intelligence gathering capability has been leaked to the public, not only by Edward Snowden and Bradley Manning, but also by government officials. And the process, of course, has been disclosed also by to those who mean us harm, including not only terrorist groups, but also state actors like Russia, China, and Iran. And it's not simply the leaks themselves that have done and continue to do the damage. The information stolen by Snowden is being dribbled out over a period that could go on for a year or more. But beyond the substance of the leaked information, there's been a cascade of misinformation about the NSA's intelligence gathering capability that has generated pressure from both the left and the right of the political spectrum to severely restrict the gathering of intelligence that is this country's first and in some cases its only line of defense. This is not the first time in our history that something like that has happened, although it is the first time that it's happened on this scale. Jack Goldsmith, in an excellent book called The Terror Presidency, published in 2007, described what he called cycles of aggression and timidity in our intelligence community. And as he describes it, political leaders, and he might just as well have mentioned opinion leaders, both in and out of government, including academics and journalists, in his words, pressure the community, and that's the intelligence community, to engage in controversial actions at the edges of the law, and then fail to protect it from recriminations when things go awry. This leads the community to retrench and become risk-averse, which invites complaints by politicians that the community is fecklessly timid. Intelligence excesses in the 1960s led to the Church Committee reproaches and reforms of the 1970s, which in turn led to complaints that the intelligence community had become too risk-averse, which in turn led to the aggressive behavior under William Casey in the 1980s that generated the Iran-Contra and related scandals, which led to another round of intelligence purges and restrictions in the 1990s that deepened the culture of risk aversion and once again led both before and after 9/11 to complaints about excessive timidity. And of course, after 9/11, we all remember the public hearings, the 9/11 Commission, and other inquiries that followed that awful day, where the narratives produced were in many instances stories of missed opportunities. The subtext of those narratives is, in fact, at times the text, was that risk aversion can have grave costs. The 9/11 Commission report, for example, tells of operations against Osama bin Laden that were contemplated but not executed, of surveillance considered but not requested, of information not shared, of so-called dots not connected. The complaints about risk aversion national security lawyers were commonplace in the first few years following September 11. About a year after the attacks, a prominent U.S. senator said, and these are his words, "We are not living in times in which lawyers can say no to an operation just to play it safe. We need excellent, aggressive lawyers who give sound, accurate legal analysis, not lawyers who say no to an otherwise legal operation just because it's easier to put on the brakes." And I'm sure it's going to surprise you, as it did me, to hear that that senator was a Democrat. This time around, the cycle threatens to damage not only careers of people involved in gathering intelligence, which is bad enough for the injury that it causes, both to the talented and dedicated people we rely on to keep us safe, and the lesson that it teaches other talented and dedicated people we should be able to rely on to keep us safe, but also for the institutions themselves in which those careers are pursued. To some degree, the CIA, a civilian institution, but also the NSA, the National Security Agency, a military institution. The first of two laws that I'd like to discuss, and not in a lot of detail, but in enough to get you to think at least, laws put in place after 9/11, is Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act, a law passed in the immediate wake of 9/11, which allows the FBI to apply for an order from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to require the production of tangible things, such as business records needed for an investigation to obtain foreign intelligence information about a non-U.S. person, or to protect the country against international terrorism. And using that provision, The FBI has obtained a series of business records orders that are renewable at 90-day intervals, which authorize the gathering of what is called telephone metadata. The NSA, which has the technical capacity, acts on that order to acquire telephone metadata in bulk. Metadata is simply the information that the telephone company has about every call made that's used to generate a typical telephone bill. The calling number, the number called, the date, duration of the call. It does not include information about the content of the call or even about who the caller is and who the person is that he or she called. What the NSA does is to aggregate the data from several companies, preserve it in one place so that it's not discarded in the normal course of business or stored in ways that are incompatible one with the other, as the telephone companies do, and so that it can be readily accessed. The order, which has been approved and reapproved more than 35 times by at least 14 different federal judges on the FISA court since 2006, does not allow random searching of the database. The program has been found many times to be entirely consistent with the Constitution and entirely lawful. When the system was generating an algorithm that caused some of the few searches that were done to go beyond what was permissible, that excess was pointed out to the FISA court by the government itself, and the judge who heard that case and who criticized the NSA in this instance nonetheless reauthorized the program. The metadata, which after all is lawfully in the hands of the telephone companies, is not information in which any caller has a reasonable expectation of privacy and therefore is not constitutionally protected. So what's the information useful for? If the government has access to a suspicious number, say a foreign terrorist cell phone or a safe house, it can then run that number against the database of U.S. numbers to determine whether that number has called or been called by a number in the United States, and then examine what numbers both inside and outside the United States that number has called. Now, obviously, if there's been contact between a suspicious number overseas and a number in the United States, further investigation can be had, and if facts are gathered that establish probable cause to believe that a crime either has been or is being committed, a warrant can be obtained to listen to the conversations on the U.S. number. There's no listening to conversations unless a warrant is issued, and the standard for issuing it is the same as the standard in normal criminal cases. The database of numbers is segregated, not accessed for any purpose beyond this specific counterterrorism program, and the government is required to follow procedures that are overseen by the court to minimize any unnecessary dissemination of U.S. numbers generated as a result of queries to the database. As you can imagine, that can be and is a valuable tool for protecting us from foreign-based terrorists or from domestic terrorists with foreign connections, and for detecting networks of people in this country who have ties to foreign terrorists. It's virtually the only way that the government can look outward from the United States to see what's coming in from overseas. Unless we rely on the good fortune of discovering something overseas with the cooperation of our foreign partners. At a minimum, it can tell us that a foreign group that we're looking at has not contacted anyone in the United States, and so we don't have to waste valuable resources or alarm people unnecessarily. In addition to being subject to court approval, the valuable Section 215 metadata program is overseen by the executive branch and by Congress, specifically the Foreign Intelligence and Judiciary Committees of both houses. When Section 215 was reauthorized in 2011, the administration briefed members of Congress and the members of those committees on the details of that program and provided briefing documents, which it asked be made available to all members of Congress and were. Those documents included the specific disclosure that under the program, NSA acquires the call detail metadata for, and this is right from the briefing document itself, substantially all of the telephone calls handled by the companies, meaning the phone companies, including both calls made between the United States and a foreign country and calls made entirely within the United States, unquote. The committees provided briefings on those details to all interested members of Congress. In other words, any member of Congress who was there in 2011 either got briefed on this, particularly if that member was a member of either of the intelligence committees or one of the judiciary committees, or had the chance to get briefed on it. They've all had the chance to get briefed on it following the Snowden leaks. So when you hear folks in Congress behaving like Louis the Prefect in Casablanca and saying that they are shocked, shocked to see that there is wiretapping going on or surveillance going on, you should react the way people reacted when Louis was given his winnings by a nearby assistant. The other program is administered under Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. That program allows the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence to authorize jointly, for up to a year, surveillance that's targeted at foreign persons who are reasonably believed to be located outside the United States, provided the FISA court approves the targeting procedures under which that surveillance occurs and the minimization procedures that govern the use of the information that's gathered. Under this program, NSA can operate within the United States to gather the content of telephone calls and internet traffic of people outside this country. How is that possible? Well, it's possible because internet and telephone messages overseas pass through computer servers in the United States. So although a telephone conversation or an exchange of email may be between parties located entirely outside this country, the NSA can monitor cables that are passing through the United States to get that information. The NSA generates specific identifiers that may include, for example, telephone numbers or email addresses of foreign persons outside the United States. And the NSA then uses those identifiers to pick out of the stream of communications those that are relevant. The surveillance by law may not target anyone of any nationality known to be within this country or intentionally target a U.S. person anywhere in the world. In order to get the content of the communications involving anyone in this country or any citizen anywhere in the world, it's necessary for a judge to issue a warrant supported by a showing of probable cause, just as one would to intercept communications in ordinary criminal investigations. The ballyhoo and the mythology that has grown up around these laws, which I will discuss in a bit, isn't entirely the result of the Manning and Snowden leaks. It is paradoxically, in part, the result of leaks from within an administration that appears to pride itself on how diligently it prosecutes leakers. Recall the president's triumphant disclosure at the time of the killing of Osama bin Laden in May 2011. Not only had bin Laden been killed, but we had done it with the help of a Pakistani doctor who agreed to try to gather the DNA information from the bin Laden compound under the guise of giving polio inoculations. And we had gathered a trove of intelligence information from bin Laden's hideaway, disclosures that, of course, got that Pakistani doctor a life jail sentence and meant that the people about whom we had gathered intelligence were immediately warned and could change their location and their means of communication. Of course, no one was prosecuted for those leaks, which came from the mouth of the president himself, which proves the truth of the sardonic observation that the ship of state is perhaps the only ship that leaks from the top. Remember also the disclosures about the Stuxnet virus that took place in June of 2012 during a presidential campaign in which the administration was attacked for its reluctance to take on enemies abroad and for less than fulsome support for Israel. The press then disclosed that in 2010, centrifuges at Iranian nuclear facilities had been attacked by a computer virus called Stuxnet as part of a program codenamed Olympic Games, and that both the United States and the Israelis had had a hand in introducing that virus into Iranian nuclear installations. Now understand that that kind of information and that kind of program is treated at the highest level of classification and made known only to a few people within the administration. It's the sort of thing that is discussed in only two places. One is within whichever agency, be it the NSA or the CIA, is operationally involved in actually doing whatever it is that's being done. And the other is in the White House Situation Room, where the policy underlying such a program would be discussed and debated among those people who had to know about it, including the Defense Secretary, whichever intelligence agency is involved, the State Department because of possible international repercussions, the Justice Department to tease out whatever legal issues may be involved in such a program, and the President and Vice President and their respective national security advisors. That's it. In response, the Attorney General designated not one, but two U.S. attorneys to look into the matter. Has anyone in this room heard of anybody actually being prosecuted for that leak? I don't see any hands. Funny, me neither. And last summer, when U.S. embassies abroad were closed in the face of what were said to be threats from al-Qaeda, someone in the administration, again, not clear who, disclosed that those threats became known as the result of electronic surveillance overhearing a conversation between Ayman al-Zawahiri, the current head of al-Qaeda, and Nasser al-Wahaishi, the head of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is the al-Qaeda franchise headquartered in Yemen. Whoever it was just couldn't resist making that disclosure that gave away a key operational secret and dried up a potentially valuable source of electronic intelligence. Those tactical leaks are damaging in two ways, both for the information they disclose and for the standard they set and the expectations they create, that disclosure of confidential information is acceptable, even desirable, and is certainly not harmful. But harmful as they have been, they have not nearly marked the outer limit. In 2009 and 2010, an Army Corporal, Bradley Manning, downloaded thousands of classified documents describing everything from diplomatic communications to particular military operations and procedures in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then caused them to be disclosed to a website dedicated to disclosing government secrets, particularly secrets of Western governments, and most particularly secrets of the United States government. That website is run by a man named Julian Assange, who has become something of a counterculture hero, sort of a cyber Robin Hood, stealing from Western governments and giving to the world, which, in addition to the idly curious, includes a whole lot of people who mean us harm. And then beginning last May, we've been treated to a steady drip of leaked documents that were stolen by Edward Snowden when he was employed by a subcontractor of NSA in Hawaii. Snowden's disclosures are particularly harmful for several reasons. First, he made off with material that would disclose to anybody knowledgeable in the field not only confidential information, but also some of the techniques that are used to acquire it. Also, because Snowden fled first to China, Hong Kong is now, of course, a province of China, and then to Russia, it's clear that whatever he stole is already in the hands of the Chinese and the Russians, whether he has released it publicly or not, and whether he gave it to them voluntarily or not. You better believe that whatever was on his computer or accessible through his computer is in their hands. The House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, which is known in Washington parlance as HPSI, has recently received a classified report from the Defense Department, particularly on the harm caused by the Snowden disclosures. The report itself remains largely classified, but what's already clear is that although press reports have focused on NSA's foreign intelligence collection, much of the information Snowden stole relates to current military operations, and in the words of HPSI Chairman Mike Rogers, is likely to have lethal consequences for our troops in the field. According to the ranking member of that committee, Dutch Ruppersberger, we have already seen terrorists changing their methods because of those leaks. The operations affected range beyond terrorism into cybercrime and narcotics and human trafficking. In fact, a program in Latin America that had helped rescue women in that part of the world from human trafficking rings had to be abandoned because documents relating to it were leaked and the identity of informants compromised. Vital operations of all four military services have been affected. Snowden's and Manning's disclosures are harmful in yet another way, and that is that they're being presented to the American people not merely by Snowden and Manning, but rather by publicity-minded surrogates. In the case of Manning, it's Julian Assange, who's a self-absorbed anarchist of sorts who professes to believe that no government should exist, let alone have secrets. In the case of Snowden, it's Glenn Greenwald, a blogger with a long history of hysterical and anti-American and anti-Israeli propaganda. They have sold the public in general, and some conservatives in particular, on the idea that what they have disclosed is that the United States government is secretly spying on all its citizens, on their communications, and indeed on all aspects of their lives that involve any electronic interaction, whether through email, banking, telephone calls, credit card transactions, you name it. They portray Snowden and Manning as romantic and idealistic, rather than self-absorbed and traitorous, as people who more closely resemble Robin Hood than Alger Hiss or Benedict Arnold. And the popular press, which of course has an ongoing interest in being able to get more stories from Greenwald and others, has gone along with this message in the way the that it reports the information. Now, I suspect there would be a good deal less support for those heroes if people were aware of who they really are and what they really think. So let's look for a moment just at Edward Snowden, perhaps the most celebrated of these so-called whistleblowers. Horn tutors would actually be more accurate. Actually, what I would have liked to do at this point is to quote extensively from what Snowden wrote before he knew that the world was watching and listening. But I can't do that extensively because a lot of what he wrote is the sort of thing that you don't repeat in mixed company or even in polite company. So let's just do a quick flyover. Snowden's version of the story is that he becomes politically aware while working for the CIA in Geneva in 2007. When he sees surveillance going on that he thinks is improper, he considers leaking information at that time but decides not to because Barack Obama gets elected and has promised hope and change. Well, there's no change, and Snowden loses hope, so he starts downloading information while he was employed at Dell in 2012. Then he lands a job in Hawaii with an NSA contractor, a job he accepted so that he could get access to even greater quantities of information. He said that he had only the purest of motives. The NSA presented what he saw as, in his words, an existential threat to democracy. Sounds great, except it's likely not quite the truth. A more accurate account may be had in an article by Sean Wilentz that appeared in January of this year in the New Republic, in which I recommend each of you. Snowden is a high school dropout who developed an interest in computers and, by his own description, joined a group of what he's called alpha geeks, exploring the mysteries of sex and online gaming, and sometimes firearms. At one point, he boasted that he had a Walther P-22 that he said he, quote, loved to death, unquote. In 2004, he enlists in an Army Special Forces program, but soon afterward is granted a medical discharge when he breaks both legs in a training accident, which is something of a curiosity because later on he develops an avocation for kickboxing. He says he joined the Special Forces because he felt it was his, quote, obligation to help free people from oppression, unquote. His first employment by an intelligence entity is as a security guard at the CIA. He then becomes a security specialist and in 2007 is posted to Geneva. Now, however Snowden felt about the administration that was then in power, as late as January 2009, he's attacking the New York Times for exposing a plan to sabotage Iran's nuclear facilities, saying that the newspaper was like WikiLeaks and deserved to go bankrupt. He urges that whoever leaked, quote, classified shit, his words, not mine, to the Times should be shot in the testicles. That's not the word he used, but you get the picture. Economically, he supported Ron Paul's position that we should return to the gold standard and urged that Social Security be abolished. He wrote that old people, quote, wouldn't be expletive helpless if you weren't sending them expletive checks to sit on their ass and lay in hospitals all day, unquote. He made two $250 contributions to Ron Paul during the 2012 primaries. Although Snowden claims that he got access to highly sensitive information at NSA by working his way up with his considerable talents, it appears that the way he got it was by tricking one or more of his coworkers into disclosing their passwords so that he could then unleash a program that would go through the data to which they had access and pick out information of a type that had been written into the program. Snowden's denials here are particularly illuminating. In fact, they're downright Clintonian. He denies that there were legions of coworkers whose passwords he stole, leaving open, of course, the possibility that it was only one or two. He says he never stole any classified documents, leaving open that he simply inserted a program that accomplished the theft. He denies that he disclosed any secret information, claiming in the next breath that he simply disclosed it to journalists and they decided what to publish and what not, an act he considers entirely reasonable and responsible. Of course, the journalist to whom he leaked the information was the aforementioned journalist for The Guardian, and sometime blogger named Glenn Greenwald, and there's not enough time to explore his history except to note that he too journeyed through support for Ron Paul and arrived at a worldview that seems congenial both to the far right and to the far left critics of our country's national security. What this has produced is kind of an odd coalition of the extreme left, which suspects and opposes any intelligence gathering program as an actual or potential infringement of civil liberties, and the libertarian right, which suspects any branch of the government and delights in conjuring up images of Big Brother so that the narrative of a spying and infringing government comes naturally to them. As a result, we saw in the last Congress that almost half the House of Representatives voted to defund the programs that I've been describing, led by a coalition of libertarian Republicans and left-wing Democrats. This trend is being exploited, whether ignorantly or cynically, by senators who range from Patrick Leahy on the left to Rand Paul on the right. The president has gone from a supporter of the NSA to calling for, quote, reforms, unquote, in intelligence gathering that aren't necessary even on his own evidence, and for more transparency in the kind of activity that, by definition, cannot be effective except to the extent that it's opaque. If techniques and programs are openly discussed and debated, obviously our enemies are listening in on the debate and learning from it. It's not simply the possible legislative degrading of intelligence gathering from outside that is the danger. If you were working for NSA and listening to the debate as it's gone on, and you were aware of the cycles of aggression and timidity that Jack Goldsmith described in his book, and the damage to the careers and lives of members of the intelligence community that's been done during these cycles, during the cycles of timidity, how would you approach your job? If you were a lawyer in the National Security Division of the Justice Department or in the Office of Legal Counsel, how far would you push in assessing what's permissible when we try to gather evidence about foreign terrorist threats? Recall that two Justice Department lawyers, John Yoo and Jay Bybee, one of whom is a tenured professor at Berkeley and the other a circuit judge, came within an eyelash of being recommended for disbarment for legal opinions that they rendered about the lawfulness of the CIA interrogation program in the months after 9/11. And then we have the recent report by a bare 3-2 majority of something called the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, PCLOB in Washington speak, which has no authority to conduct a legal analysis of the NSA intelligence gathering program, and has neither the authority nor, frankly, the talent to review the effectiveness of that program, but which recently issued a report anyway, saying the program is both unlawful and unnecessary. To be sure, the two dissenters showed why the majority report was hardly worth the 80 pages that it was written on, but it's still a straw in the wind. If you were in the intelligence gathering business and you had a family and a mortgage, how eager would you be in this climate to render an opinion based on what you think is the limit of what the law actually allows, if you think that limit might change? Self-censorship is a real danger. Now, I've met and spoken with General Keith Alexander, who headed NSA, even after the Snowden leaks and the contrived uproar of press and Congress. He didn't flinch. He said that most of his career was clearly behind him, so he doesn't have to be concerned. But you worry how long that kind of resilience can go on. Keith Alexander is retiring, and the NSA is going to be headed by somebody else. There's a passage in the Bible that describes how trouble started. It came to pass that there was a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. That's when the trouble started. But even if the successor is as stalwart as General Alexander was, no one person can carry a whole agency on his back. That's particularly true in the time that we're living in, when our principal threat comes not from a particular nation state, which is what the structure of our government was designed to deal with, but from an ideology that, although it's centered principally in the Middle East, can manifest itself anywhere and has. It's an ideology that intends to present us with the same choices that were recently presented to Christians in a city in Syria that came to be controlled by an entity called the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS. That choice was either convert to Islam or assume a state of second-class citizenship known as dhimmitude, or face the sword. The Christians in that city reportedly agreed to the second choice, which includes not building or repairing churches, paying a special tax levied on non-believers, not displaying Christian symbols, not using amplifiers in their prayers, among other restrictions. Those are the stakes, folks, and that's what's going to fill the vacuum if we don't. Thank you very much.
General Mukasey has kindly agreed to answer a few questions. I don't think we have mics here, so we're going to be relying on the people. We do. I'm wrong. So please raise your hand and have the mic come to you. He will take the questions. As we're waiting for people to form questions, I'm going to ask him one. One of the things that was discussed a lot at the conference was whether there are not, how much of the data that's being collected, how useful it really is, and how much some of the data that was already collected hasn't really been effectively used. Specifically in the case of the Boston bombing was one example. I don't know if you care to comment on that at all, but that's the...
Some data hasn't been effectively used, and yes, the Boston bombers got through. It depends, I suppose, on how you measure effective use of data. If you measure it as finding out about a plot when the plotter is about to chamber around and fire, then not much use. But if you're talking about using it the way intelligence is actually used, which is together with all other information that's gathered, it's enormously useful. And it has resulted in the rolling up of many groups and many people. It hasn't resulted in it alone, and you certainly don't get the sort of jump shot at the buzzer phenomenon. But the fact is that if the only shot that you're concerned about is the jump shot at the buzzer, then the game isn't going to be won because it's all the shots that were taken before that count.
Greetings, Attorney General. I was at the Barbara Olson lecture that you gave several years ago and warning about the Muslim Brotherhood, which at the time was taking power in Egypt. Now having, and I guess people were misled because Morsi wore a suit and tie and thought we could deal with them. Having seen the events of the last couple of years, where would you see things going with the Muslim Brotherhood and the situation in the Middle East?
Well, of course, the Egyptians got a horse doctor's dose of the Muslim Brotherhood, and millions of them poured into the streets and expressed their view of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is now out of power. As far as mistaking people who wear suits for people we can deal with. That problem's been going on for a long time. So many of you here, I think, are too young to remember the string of Soviet premiers we had for a while. They didn't have a very long shelf life for a time. And what would happen, each time one of them kicked off, there would be a funeral in Moscow, and U.S. politicians would go to the funeral, and then invariably they would come back and announced that the new guy was a man of peace. And you scratch your head and wonder. Now, there are hundreds of world leaders who attend those ceremonies. Obviously, they don't speak Russian, and the new premier didn't speak English. So how long could he have spoken to them? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? 10 minutes, okay. That means 5 minutes of actual communication because you have to allow for the translation. You have to devote at least a couple of minutes to talking about the guy in the box. So that leaves what? 2 minutes to talk about, I don't understand what those people could have been saying in 2 minutes that added up to them being men of peace. And usually what it came down to is a rumor that they drank scotch and listened to jazz. And the same, of course, is true making the necessary changes today. Look at the new president of Iran. He, in fact, was the head of the organization that helped massacre people by the thousands back in the day, but he's now praised as a moderate. He was the minister of justice when people were being massacred, as I said, by the thousands. This is a man who is called a moderate. We have somebody in Tunisia who was praised as a moderate, because he joked about allowing the use of liquor in Tunisia, who also advocated the hanging of two female professors for advocating rights for women. We have another theologian who was pronounced to be a moderate. Because he makes soft cooing noises in the West, He's a moderate. He's actually something of a feminist. He issued a fatwa authorizing women to participate in suicide bombings. I think people need to do a whole lot of research on who the moderates are before they are embraced in the West. Gentleman in the back.
Thank you very much, Attorney General. I was particularly impressed with your psychological kind of evaluation of today's characters in the news, and I just wanted to get your take on what you thought was behind the kind of unthoughtful criticism of our, you know, more or less reasonable security measures from the right, you know, from people like you said, like Rand Paul and the others. So,
well, sad to say, there are only two alternatives. One is that they don't know any better. And the second is that they do know better, but figure the people they're talking to don't know any better. Either way, it's not very flattering. I've been in a room with one of them, and it's not Rand Paul, but one of the others, who I paid a couple hundred dollars to have lunch with, and asked him during his remarks about the NSA surveillance program, and his response consisted first of all of saying, "Oh yes, I know you've wrestled with that issue." When I pointed out that I thought that I had won that wrestling match, but I wanted to see how he would do, he did a 2-minute tap dance and danced away from it. I think that there are people who are willing to believe that government agencies are engaged in essentially a plot against American freedoms. And in some cases, notably the IRS, they're right. But you know what? There's no such thing as the United States government. They're just a bunch of people. Some of them are highly motivated, highly competent, and highly honorable, and some of them are none of the above. The none of the aboves work at the IRS. The others work at the NSA. I mean, stop and consider it. The people who work at the NSA, what's their worst nightmare? Another 9/11. You think they seriously have time to worry about what books you're buying, even if they honed in on that? That's ridiculous.
Good evening, General. Is this on? Okay. There was talk earlier during the conference, and then you mentioned it, of course, about the notorious leakers, you know, Mr. Snowden and Private Manning. And I just wondered, in addition to what other panelists had said earlier, if you have any thoughts on remedies for the kind of enormous damage or amount of data that they were allowed to handle, even at a low level that they seem to be at, and what to do about that. Because it seems like it will happen again and again.
I was a liberal arts major, so I'm not technically competent. Understand that. But I also have a credit card that's issued by a bank. And every so often, as I'm sure the same experience you've had, you get a call from the bank that says, "Are you in Bimini?" And you say, "No, I'm not in Bimini." "Well, interesting, your credit card is in Bimini," and they notice an irregular pattern and cut it off. I don't understand, particularly in Manning's case, how it was that a system supposedly as sensitive as the system that he was tapped into could not detect that a private was downloading hundreds of thousands of documents in which he had no business. You ought to be able to detect that, and my guess is that they can now. With respect to Snowden, the story is a little bit tougher because the techniques are tougher, and I don't entirely understand them. I do understand that as I've heard, that Hawaii was essentially the last place to get the kind of technological fixes that would have made it difficult for him to do what he did, was to shut down a system, take stuff out, and then restart it. I'm not sure exactly how that works, but whether he was aware of that before he went or not, I don't know. There are theories that he was being run either by the Chinese or the Russians or some combination of the two. But the short of it is, yeah, we always, you know, we manage to lock the horse, to lock the barn door after the horse is out. But part of it, I think, has to do with the way this stuff is received. The fact is that there's no public outrage, or very little. And unless and until there's public outrage, there is an incentive simply for people who want to get their 15 minutes to do it.
Over here, General McKenzie.
I'm sorry, yes.
I know in one of the trials over which you presided, you know, you heard recordings where terrorists talked about how easy it was to get anything in America, be it detonators, pornography, anything. You know, with the Boston Marathon about a month away, where do you think we stand on that now, and how the security measures you talked about, you know, how they help to prevent this sort of thing?
Well, I think, I actually think that security in this country is in pretty fair shape, based just my gut belief. But the fact is, we do have an open society, and yes, these people do regard that as an enormous weakness. They regard it as a reason why we are ripe for plucking. The conversation that you described was presented on a tape that was recorded by somebody who had infiltrated this conspiracy undercover. And he was walking on Canal Street in New York looking for electronics to use as a detonator. And he started to talk about what a decadent country this is, where you can get anything. You can get electronics, you can get pornography, any kind of, you know, be free associated into all the availability of all kinds of material that's not available elsewhere. And regarded that as a reason why this country was, not his phrase, but this is the way he portrayed it, as ripe for plucking. And there are people who actually think that way, and there are a lot of them. But we can't give that up, and we shouldn't give it up, but we don't have to give it up. What we have to do is be alert and use our common sense.
I'm wondering how you compare Edward Snowden and the private to Alger Hiss. Hiss was actually very well protected for decades. And then there were the Rosenbergs, of course. But I'm just kind of curious how you see what went on.
You mean the damage done by Hiss, the Rosenbergs, and compared to the damage done by Snowden?
And the way they were treated, and how Snowden and the private are being treated.
The fact is, as I think we are going to find out when the report that was given to the House committee is gradually, portions of it at least are gradually declassified. What Snowden did was far worse than anything the Rosenbergs did and anything that Alger Hiss did. It is far more damaging than anything that they did. And the fact that he has been received and is acclaimed in some quarters as a hero is a disaster. Because what it means is that we are not going to get our minds around stopping it unless and until there is condemnation of that kind of activity.
Hi. My name is Catherine Trent. I've listened tonight, and I am one of those conservatives that you were just speaking about when you classified the Rand Paul conservatives. My question to you is, since our country right now is in a position of only having control of the House, and we desperately need to unify, do you think that it's wise to get your most principled base, those of us who are extremely conservative and pay our taxes, we're very responsible, but we believe in our Constitution. Do you think that it's wise to put us to the side and make our opinion not matter?
Nobody's putting anybody to the side who believes in the Constitution of the United States. But what I am saying is that things happen one way and one way only, which is to say either the government is, in fact, listening in on your conversations and monitoring your credit card information, or it isn't. And that exploiting the belief that it does is simply cynical manipulation. And my regard for people who do that is that they are not fit for serious leadership positions. Now, I happen to think that being a senator is not necessarily a significant leadership position. I mean, the one thing that I was grateful for when I was in Washington was that the legislators did what they did and that the people in the executive did what they did. The one thing that horrified me was that we would have some sort of perverse version of camper counselor day one day where the campers would take the place of the counselors would take the place of the campers, and the lunatics would be running the asylum. We didn't do that, luckily. I mean, senators get up, they make speeches, and by and large it's fairly harmless, but the notion that somebody with views like that should be put in a serious executive position, I think is terrifying.
General Mukasey, thanks for your remarks. You narrated sort of the history of the intelligence community sort of after the World War II era, the ebbs and flows. We heard today that the 215 program is going to sunset next year. Are we entering a new period of risk?
If it in fact sunsets, yes. We're in a new period of risk regardless because of Snowden's disclosures. Those are an absolutely unmitigated disaster, as we will find out. We've got to stop fishtailing and veering back and forth, because understand that the people who terrorists, for example, may come at this from a sort of a 7th century viewpoint, but they have access to 21st century technology, and they're not going to stop using it.